one of the things that I always talk to young audio dramatists when they're talking about what's the most important thing. It's kind of like, it's to have an idea of the space you're in. And that seems to work best for actors too, when you're talking to them, you know, imagine the space you're in. When I was the reporter and I'm whispering into my microphone because something's going on in the distance, and other times when I'm screaming over the sound of the mechanical monster that's coming into the city, what creates the various spaces you're in?
Well, greetings, friends, and welcome in to this, the 255th edition of Fusebox, where on this special edition of the show, we're going to celebrate the wonderful contributions to not only our humble show, but to literally countless other productions, both locally and nationally, that a very, very dear friend, actor, and truly a mentor to both veteran and aspiring actors, has made over the years, Sam A. Mowry, who sadly left our reality for a command performance, no doubt standing room only, just a few short days ago. So we're going to dispense with our normal format to do just that. Celebrate the wondrous collaborations we've had over the years, and joining me on this jaunt down memory lane, as always, is the Deacon of Dials over there, Milt Keynes, everybody.
Well, thank you kindly. Yeah, what a great guy.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't know him as well as you, because I came to the party in 2015, and you two had been working together since, what, 2002?
Well, yeah, about 2003, actually. And I think Sam himself had a very good recollection of that initial meeting.
I was reading the newspaper and checking for auditions, and there was this thing about a meetup at the library for people interested in doing radio dramas. And I was like, that sounds interesting. I wonder how that would happen. So I went and showed up, and it was at the library in their big meeting room. And first thing I noticed was there were like 8 other theater people I knew who were there. And I didn't know that they were into radio. They didn't know I was into radio. And we sat there, and a young man, Michael Hopcroft, the spiritual godfather of the Willamette Radio Workshop, because he had this meeting, and he got up and explained his vision, which was a science fiction series where everyone would record their pieces at home and then send them to him, and then he would cut them all together. Now, for all of us stage actors, we were like, oh my God, that sounds terrible. We're not working with each other. How would we know how to read something if we didn't get the feedback? So we listened to his pitch, and then people started talking about reservations they had about that kind of thing. And it was basically, you'll record something on the mic on your laptop and send it to us, and 6 months from now, we'll have the finished product. And we just really weren't game for it. Then that would seem totally bizarre. Now I realize that's what 80% of the audio drama podcasts out there, that's how they're done. What happened was, after the meeting, we started talking to each other in a little group, and then I noticed these 2 people over by the side of the room, they were talking with each other, and I had very much liked what they had said in the process, and they obviously had more of an understanding of how to edit and put things together just from the questions they were asking. And so we came over and started talking to each other, and it was Mark and Rob, just hit it off right away, I'd say. And they started telling us about a project they were working on called Dry Smoke and Whispers. And he was like, yeah, we've just come to town, and yeah, we're looking for more actors, and it seems like there's some people here who want to be involved in radio. And I was like, well, sure, come on over to my house. I got a 2-car garage, and we rehearse in there. We can come in and you can audition all the actors you want. And we did, and it was a great experience. And They are both geniuses when it comes to radio drama. And, you know, we pretty much everybody who auditioned ended up doing something in the show. And that was just the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And Mark and I have done, I can't even count the number of shows that we've done over 20 years.
Nor can I, buddy. There were so many.
Well, you know, we came across that audition reel while searching for clips, yeah?
Yeah, we did. And he's right. Everybody found their way into that production because they were all so dang good.
Yeah.
It was an embarrassment of riches, as they say, to be sure. Rob, also known as Gerald McQuinn, and I were both completely stunned by the caliber of talent out here. And, you know, I came out to Portland in 1999, and Rob was already here, having moved out in 1996. Now, and we'd been talking about rebooting this radio series we produced for public radio back in the 1980s called, as Sam mentioned there, Dry Smoke and Whispers Radio Theater. Technology had changed to a degree that it would make building something as epic as we were often want to do much, much easier. Because, frankly, before this, that show...
Well, I mean, pretty much every show.
Yeah, pretty much all production was done on tape, multi-track or whatever. But that meant a lot of hands-on cutting and splicing, and it's very, very time-consuming. A typical Dry Smoke episode would have hundreds of edits involved in a three-part episode.
Didn't you tell me once, though, that you were even cutting the multi-track as well?
Oh, yeah. Had to do that, too. it was a thing. So having the opportunity to reboot this show with the type of talent we had here was a sublime gift. And that was Sam in a nutshell, really. He was a great catalyst for creative projects. He'd make introductions, sell you really hard to the person he was wanting to connect you with, and then just sit back and watch what happens. Yeah, I mean, it was glorious. It really was.
You cast him in the lead for that first episode.
Yes, we did. It was a 9-part radio series called The Shadow Man Saga, and it ran on XM Sirius satellite radio, among other places. And it was pretty ambitious. I'll say that. And Sam was perfect as the highly elusive and mysterious titular figure.
Do you hear that, Kina? He calls to the faithful. But remember this. Without trial, there is no faith. Without a crisis of faith, there is no belief. Those who experience nothing have no heart to believe with.
That's pretty prophetic there, Mr. Rose.
Yeah. The series was written by Gerald McQuinn, and I know for a fact that Gerald was greatly inspired by the folks we had to work with in terms of acting chops here. Like I say, we were just like kids in a candy store coming out here.
Kind of old, creepy kids, but yeah.
Let me see what you got.
Well, be that as it wasn't. So that was 2004, or thereabouts, when that production began. And somewhere near the end of the production of the Shadow Man Saga, we had learned of this exciting new format that was taking the country by storm. A format soon to be known as...
podcasting.
And the world was made worse ever since.
Well, in those early days, and that would have been 2005 for us, we created a very successful little comedy show called Area 51.
Transmission is imminent.
Area 51.
This program was hosted by Douglas Scott and Bobby Black. And it was a fun and funny show that was always in the top 10 of comedy programs of that era. It even got the magic wand endorsement of the self-proclaimed godfather of podcasting, Adam Curry, which seriously impacted the amount of folks downloading the show back then.
Didn't it break the server?
Well, yeah, it did, because seriously, prior to this, we were hosting it ourselves, you know, on a little regular server somewhere, and, you know, it wasn't meant to accommodate that many requests. But yes, we later moved it off, of course, and yes, but I digress. So, Douglas wrote this bit involving another shadowy figure that was trying to control the Area 51 show's direction, as well as the show's hosts themselves. To serve a rather, I'd say, nefarious end game, not wanted at all by the humble hosts. So in this bit, we created a character for Sam called Mr. Dolls, who was a sort of Charles Foster Kane character.
Oh, yeah, from Citizen Kane, yeah?
Right, yeah, crossed with, I would say, Ned Beatty's immortal character in Network, the film by Paddy Chayefsky made in the late 70s. This short bit here is where Bobby Black gets summoned to the huge Doll's estate for a little conversation on how things actually are.
Here we are. You may now enter, Mr. Black.
Yeah, right. Hello? Dolls? Dolls!
Over here by the fireplace, Mr. Black.
You ever hear it turn on the lights? I can't see a thing, man.
Follow the sound of my voice, Mr. Black.
Look, I'm not going to be here long. I came here to humor you, whoever you really are, and to explain a few things about how I operate.
Robert Holden Black.
Yeah.
Born Dickens, Arkansas, 1972.
Yeah.
Attended William Jennings Bryan Elementary, Jefferson Davis Junior High, Stonewall Jackson High School. Girlfriends, Josie Ann Kemperer, Mary Tyler, Jessica Watson.
Yeah.
To whom you attended your senior prom.
Yeah, that's right.
Very attractive young woman.
Hey, listen, freak.
Arrest record, age 10. Public drunkenness and disturbing the peace. Poughkeepsie, New York, 1986.
Yeah, so what?
Assault on a professional sports mascot. Yankee Stadium, New York City, New York, 1990.
Look, okay, great. So you got some juice. Just give me the bottom line, you know? Who are you, man? What do you want?
I'm Charles Dolls, Mr. Black. I'm the president of the network.
Big deal.
Family, Mr. Black. We need family listeners. We need everyone. Every little consumer. And that mission demands no controversy, no opinions, no ideas. Content without content. Empty pots and advertising. World without end. Amen. Amen. Mr. Black, you are playing with a force of nature. You are toying with a power that is far beyond your understanding. Your very existence is, shall we say, provisional. You're frail. You're not immortal.
Yeah, yeah, you got that network vibe going on there. Only thing is, bro, what the hell happened next?
Sadly, I have no idea. There was a continuance of this bit, but those segments are hiding deep in the archive. So deep, in fact, I might have to get Iko and Milo, the Japanese pocket squirrels, to do that research, because I can't get down in there. Well, needless to say, I continued my collaboration with Sam for 21 years. A lot of productions where I just contributed some music and sound design cues to the Willamette Radio Workshop's live shows. But there was one such production that we really had a fabulous time creating, and that was Archibald MacLeish's Fall of the City, a truly remarkable piece written in the 1930s, and at least at the time that we had produced this thing, the work had only really been performed twice. The first time was with Orson Welles himself. Here's Sam to tell you a little bit more about it.
It's been perfect for every generation since it was written. Sadly, we don't learn these lessons, but it's a beautiful piece. And so I brought it back and played it for the whole group, and everybody loved it. And we decided we would go ahead and do it and talk to Mark about it. And he was like, oh, yeah, I love that. And so he came in on it, and we did it. In one day, we recorded over at PCC Sylvania's theater. We were able to rent the theater for a day, and we had the entire cast in there. We did all the live Foley of the crowds, and it was just a really special day. And Mark was going to do the sound design, and he said, "Oh well, give it to me, and I'll let you know when I'm done." And it seemed like it was just a couple of days. It might have been longer, but it seemed like an impossibly short amount of time. He showed up with this, and it was just perfect. It was the most amazing sound design I'd ever heard. I couldn't believe it was us.
The street's empty, in shadow. The crowd is retreating, watching the empty street. The shouts die. The voices are silent. They're watching. They stand in the slant of the sunlight, silent and watching. The silence after the drums echoes the drum beat. Now there's a sound. They see him. They must see him. They're shading their eyes from the sun. There's a rustle of whispering. They can't see for the glare of it. Yes. Yes. He's there in the end of the street in the shadow. We see him. He's huge. A head taller than anyone else. As broad as a brass door, a hard hero, heavy of heel on the brick, clanking with metal, the helm closed on his head, the eye holes hollow. He's coming. He's clear of the shadow. The sun takes him. They cover their faces with fingers. They cower before him, they fall. They sprawl on the stone. He's alone where he's walking. Marches with rattled metal. He tramples his shadow. He mounts by the pyramid, stamps on the stairway, turns. His arm rises. His visor is opening. It's no one. There's no one at all. No one. The helmet is hollow. A metal is empty. The armor is empty. I tell you, there's no one there at all. It's only the metal, the barrel of metal, the bundle of armor. It's empty. The push of a stiff pull at the nipple would topple it. They don't see. They lie on the paving. They lie in the burnt spears, the ashes of arrows. They lie there. They don't see or won't see. They're silent. The people invent their oppressors. They wish to believe in them. They wish to be free of their freedom, released from their liberty. The long labor of liberty ended. They lie there. Look, it's his arm. It's rising. His arm's rising. They're watching his arm as it rises. They stir. They cry. They cry out. They're shouting. They're shouting with happiness. Listen, they're shouting like troops in a victory. Listen! The city of masterless men has found a master. You'd say it was they were the conquerors. They that had conquered. The city has fallen.
the city is failing.
We were able to later perform a version of this production live as well, and that was a treat. I think for Sam and I, though, this was a true high point in the work we got to do together. The chap who facilitated that live Fall of the City show is John Barber, an educator at Washington State University and host of his own radio program called Reimagined Radio. And a link to his programs are in the show description as well. John is another catalyst for good. He's oftentimes been the lightning rod for trying something new or suggesting a different direction. And one day, back in 2010, I think it was, he suggested to Gerald and I that we should submit something to this group called Radio Zero. Now, this was a multi-day event held in Portugal that would broadcast works from producers from all over the world. Well, seriously, that was very exciting to us.
But you only had 5 hours?
Almost. I think we had about 2 weeks to come up with something and submit it. So we thought about it, and Gerald had the idea that what we should do is take all of these concepts that we've developed over the years, the dry smoke dimension, the Farwan concept, which was a rather wondrous place with exotic people and wildlife, and place them in a sort of news magazine from another dimension kind of setting. Kind of an off-world NPR documentary, but at the same time, throw Earth into the mix, too, for all the quirks it has, and show the relationships between all of these places.
Oh, sure. Just let me throw that together and...
Well, I gotta tell you, man, it was actually a hell of a lot easier than you might think, as we had so much pre-existing material that we could stitch it together and add some new material for bridging, and hopefully it would, in fact, stick together. We employed some familiar voices to the Fusebox listeners, Jody Lorimer, for one, who was our network anchor, and, of course, Sam, who played, what else? Actor, narrator extraordinaire, Grendan Thales, who was from the Dry Smoke dimension, who offers some interesting commentary along the way in the form of a quasi-interview at a local eatery in Quemet, the place that Dry Smoke and Whisper stories take place. He offers some very poignant advice in this segment, has a very familiar and resonant ring to it today.
So my point is, before we write off entire cultures, I think you have to sit down and break bread with the average working people under these regimes. And 9 times out of 7, you'll find you have more in common than not. Matter of fact, it's a pet theory of mine that the internationalization of cuisine is doing more to create eventual peace in the galaxy than almost any other factor.
Which later led to his narration for the Farwan segment, a description of how the laughter of children was transformed into a light source by a famous derwaither, a Farwanese term for a magician, a chap named Fabrice Berendon.
The laughter of the children curled up from below. Mother Squanchling, a little put out by the children's persistent attention, had launched herself indignantly into the lake. 12 little ones following, bobbing and squonking in a convoy towards a patch of floating lake berries.
My, I wish I could bottle that sound,
said Anir, as the children's hilarity made them all grin. Fabrice tilted his head to one side. Clearly a thought had struck him. He stood suddenly and looked down from the pier.
Maybe that can be arranged,
he said cryptically. He stretched out one hand, and light began to glow around it. A look of intense concentration knitted his brow, but his eyes were full of mirth. Then, as the children laughed below, it was as though their breath was turning into a blue mist, the same azure as the last line of twilight on the horizon. One by one, the children grew silent. as that mist rose above their heads and began to coalesce into a shimmering cloud. Brighter and brighter it grew. All up and down the lake now, everybody sitting out on their balconies felt a joy rising in their hearts as the light grew stronger. The joy grew with it. Now it was spiraling, spinning, twisting like a comet. And in a huge arc, it suddenly flew towards the waiting Darewaither. Stretching out his left hand, a crystalline orb appeared in it. And with a blinding flash, the comet of light streaked into the globe.
I'm delighted to say that we did complete this. And later, the program won a Communicator Award for this production, and we're thrilled that we could be showcased globally like that. I will post the entire thing on our Patreon page, and that one, friends, is free to access for anyone to enjoy.
Zounds! What fuckery is this? What vile, unyielding cruelty blankets me like a cloak of black iron I cannot shed? This gnawing at my viscera, this hunger that burns at my very core, weakens me, yet cannot be satiated, as once more I am faced with obstacles thrust before me for reasons only the gods may ascertain. Lo, I stand before you, a starving man, bent and anguished, searching for respite, a mere mortal, frail, and desirous of nourishment for body and soul. Where is thy benevolence? Alas, does no one bear the humanity to intercede? What of compassion? My hunger deepens as precious reserves are depleted, fighting to stave off this cruel inquisition. What of decency? Pray, what of love? What of love?
So you want fries with that? Or not?
Well, then comes fuse box and all that highfalutin stuff goes right down the toilet.
Well, how could we leave out the fun we've had with Sam and the classic Bremerton Castlewhite character? Of course, Sam loved a parody, and he made this one his for sure. Jeff Pollard created the Bremerton character especially for Sam, as he knew it would be a blast to do, and of course, to hear. We can't leave this episode of the show without one of my personal favorite bits, written by Jeff and another Bremerton bonanza here. Well, you know, it's no secret that Sam loved the story A Christmas Carol, and each year would hold this huge reading at he and his wife Cindy's home, which oftentimes would attract hundreds of people. Yes, that's right, hundreds. It quickly became a social event of the year, where folks from the Portland theatrical community and very much beyond would all convene to have a go at the reading and just hang out and celebrate the time of year. As a tribute to that, we present to you now the dramatic stylings of Bremerton Castlewhite reading the immortal classic, "'Twas the Night Before Thursday."
"'Twas the night before Thursday in our part of the world. Not a creature was stirring, except Japanese pocket squirrels. Empty booze bottles were scattered all over the floor. We hoped Uncle Carl soon would bring more. The children all cowered neath the covers of their beds. Visions of child protective services filled them with dread. And Mama passed out naked, and I, not far behind, had poured another mugful and drunkenly reclined. When out from the kitchen there arose such a crash, I sprung from my lazy boy, drunk off my ass. Away to the kitchen I stumbled and staggered, not spilling a drop, which is really what matters. A pot on the stove had apparently caught fire, adding to the circumstance already past dire. when what to my bloodshot eyes should appear but Uncle Carl with Stefan, the neighborhood queer. With inebriated glee, the two men did dance, and I knew in a moment I had but one chance. So quick like a bunny as they fell through the door, I dove for drop bottles before they crashed to the floor. Damn it, Carl, I yelled, you clumsy old fool, you almost dropped the booze, then what would we do? To the top of his voice, Uncle Carl did laugh while backing into the stove, thus lighting his ass. And as Uncle Carl thrashed and flailed about, Stefan peed his pants, laughing, or did just about. Mama had come to and lurched through the door, with me clutching the bottles and still prone on the floor. What the hell, Carl? She screamed, shrill as a hen, startling poor Stefan, whose laughing stopped them. Quickly to the backyard, Mama did rush, grabbing the hose to douse Carl's flaming tush. Throughout the whole kitchen, cold water she did spray, soaking everything and me, where on the floor I still lay. Get out, Mama bellowed, get out of my house. You've ruined Christmas again, you drunken, clumsy louse. But Carl spoke not a word as he wrung out his pants, barely acknowledging Mama's threatening rant. Instead, he gallantly helped Stefan to his feet and took from me a bottle without missing a beat. Through the back door then, both men did stagger, I rising from the floor finally, admiring Carl's swagger. And as Stefan and Uncle Carl stumbled out of sight, I heard him exclaim, Happy Christmas, y'all, and to y'all a good night. The end.
Well, nothing like a little Xmas in August.
True. Very true, Mr. Gaines. There is so much more we could share here, but time restricts our indulgence. I will tell you, though, that the aforementioned reimagined radio with host John Barber will also be hosting a rebroadcast of a show that featured an interview with Sam, originally heard back in 2023. And it goes into much more depth than we could do here. But so glad we had the opportunity to share this with all of you. I have, of course, included a link to the WRW site so you can further dig into what those folks have been doing all these years. And it's fascinating and very enriching. So I invite you to take a look there. We're all going to just horribly miss this most generous and talented spirit. It's kind of hard imagining a world without Sam, but we carry on because the show must go on, no? On behalf of Milt and Jeff and all the folks in the Fusebox family here, we sincerely hope you enjoyed this humble tribute to Sam, and, well, we'll catch you next time. So I'm Mark Rose, saying until our next cartoon.
Fuse Box.